Let's dive right into dystopia this week, or utopia. So it wasn't really covered because everybody is still talking about Duplex, fortunately or unfortunately for Google.
Fortunately for Google. Yeah, I guess unfortunately. Depends.
Yeah.
Depends on which article.
All of them. All of them are bad. So, The Verge published this thought experiment is what Google's officially calling it. It's this like 9-minute video that describes a future that it's speculative design, which according to Google, that these kind of videos designed to explore uncomfortable ideas and concepts in order to provoke discussion and debate. So with that said, this concept involves something called a ledger. That's a constantly evolving representation of who we are. It's the information collected from our phones, tablets, computers, whatever, which can be analyzed to determine actions, decisions, preferences, movements, and even relationships. So Google imagines this ledger thing as being goal-oriented instead of just being a passive history. It's active. It's adaptive. It's adaptive. So the idea is that users can set predefined goals for their ledgers, like examples of like staying healthy or protect the environment, support local business. And then with this mock-up app that Google made, you pick one of those goals, you opt in to mass data collection, and then Google would work to make sure your actions meet those goals. So in third-party apps, there was this example of when you're picking an Uber, instead of picking the regular thing, you can pick an Uber pool, which is technically more environmentally conscious, or when you're buying groceries in the app, this pop-up appears over the locally grown fruit or other produce, and it like nudges you to pick that one. So basically, yeah, there's this whole goal-oriented system, which yeah, in itself is fine, I think.
Yeah, the part that kind of starts to worry me is whenever, you know, the ledger itself becomes, the video kind of described how, I guess the ledger, and I guess for those listening that maybe didn't watch the video yet, it might be better to describe this in simpler terms. But basically it's the system that keeps track of everything about you. Just a rolling continuous collection of data about every single aspect of you. And it described, you know, us being kind of the host or the carrier of the ledger, and rather than the ledger being, you know, its own entity, it's kind of a piece of us, and we're kind of, you know, the ones stewarding it for the time being. And the part where I guess for me it gets kind of creepy is whenever the ledger starts to become its own entity, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like one part of the video described, it described the ledger realizing, which is, it sounds ridiculous to say that, but the ledger realizing that it doesn't have a certain piece of data. In the case of this concept, that data was the weight of the user, or the weight of the ledger bearer, I guess we could say. And so, yeah, the host. Oh, it just sounds so creepy to think about. But like the host, it doesn't know the weight, and the weight is something that the ledger could use that could potentially help further the end user's goals, I guess. And so the ledger thinks by itself and thinks, okay, how can I get this piece of data? And the most obvious thing to do is to search through every, you know, scale product that's available. That's a smart scale. That's internet connected. That might, you know, be able to get that piece of data for them. And then the ledger recommends to the user, hey, we think you might be like, you might want this. It might be a good idea for you to have this so that, you know, I, the ledger, can know your weight and therefore help you more in your life, achieve your goals. And that just like, like I don't know if I guess the implications for things like this are so far beyond our comprehension that, you know, it's hard to even imagine like what the world would really look like. You know, it's like it's fun and it's cool to make a concept video, but you know, the implications for familial relationships, for, you know, just our daily lives, for our hobbies and for our lifestyle is just potentially infinite. And so it's hard to think about this really. And, you know, for someone that didn't watch the video, it's also kind of hard to describe what it's picturing, but really it's just kind of an extreme, taking to the logical conclusion what we already have in our lives. So yeah, we're all familiar with what having a Google Home looks like in our life. And I guess would you say this concept video is like taking it to the logical conclusion of what that might look like, of what these technologies might look like?
Absolutely. Like the idea was like, we're already getting these suggestions. When Waze recommends that you use an alternate route that you might not be familiar with, but it's going to be faster, or like what Google Maps is about to do in a few months with this your score thing that looks to your personal preferences and other people's histories and gives a percentage on a restaurant on whether or not you would like it. We're getting there. We're getting to a point where we're no longer trusting other people's recommendations, but we're trusting recommendations solely generated by a computer. So like you said, this is the next like 10 steps later that we could possibly eventually get to this future. But what Google, but like the other creepy, the first creepy thing is like the goals being suggested by the ledger. The second thing, which is like something that Google actually said, is like by analyzing all this data and then comparing it, let's say you're a new user or like your kid, and Google imagines being comparing your current ledger to the ledger of everybody else and before, so that they can help guide your life And the really bold thing is they think that this data can make increasingly accurate predictions about decisions and future behavior, to the point where, quote, it can develop a species-level understanding of complex issues such as depression, health, and poverty, end quote. That is going for the moon. That is going beyond the moon. That is thinking that everything we do can be quantified by data, by algorithms. And again, this is speculative. Like, I don't think we have that technology yet, but like 20 years, 30 years, who knows? This might be the future.
Yeah, I think looking just generally at AI, it's getting kind of
cultish.
It's getting kind of cultish. And that was even furthered by, I don't know, like a tweet I saw like a week ago. It's kind of becoming like a religion in some ways. So
yeah,
there are some people who are now life logging their life, like they're life logging every second and every data point they can possibly collect about their life within reason with the current abilities of technology. Mm-hmm. They're already doing this. Like some people have been doing it for years, and I've seen tweets from people who are like, I wish that I had started doing this earlier, with the end goal being that they can train in, what, 10 years? I don't know. That they can train an AI to basically be a perfect recreation of their own being and their own consciousness. So, like, I guess the idea is people are, and I guess this is kind of where it kind of becomes culty or religion-like in essence, because people are kind of looking to AI as kind of like a way to live forever in a way, you know, like they may not get to live forever, but their AI might get to live forever. And their AI in 20 or 30 years may be so indistinguishable from themselves that they effectively get to live forever, you know, as an AI. But you know, we could go down a rabbit hole on, you know, what this would mean right? How this would affect us as culture, or, you know, our as a species. But yeah, it's just crazy. And
I actually want to focus on one more, like, short term, so to speak, aspect. how about like the goals thing? Like let's say you want to be more environmentally friendly, or you want to, like, the health thing, improve your health. So you get goals, let's say, in the Starbucks app, or when you're buying food, when you're ordering food. What do you think of that? Like, what do you think of one unified system being like a coach, like a mentor in your life? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that some parts of that wouldn't necessarily require this kind of extreme version of data. I guess data vacuuming, data consumption, data logging. I don't know what you would call it. Maybe. I mean, I could see there being some kind of app or system that could be built to watch the decisions you're making across your app. So let's just talk about this in the context of a phone. So on a phone, you've got a Starbucks app, you've got an Uber Eats app, you've got an Uber app, you've got whatever apps that you use that reflect your life. I don't know if you would absolutely have to collect immense amounts of data to do the very basic version of what this video suggests, which is Google. Like, part of this video was just them showing, you know, in this app, you could, you know, choose, like you said, like the Uber pool versus the Uber X or whatever. And that could be the environmentally friendly decision. Google or whatever, company could assess that's the objectively greener decision without necessarily building this ledger, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's definitely true. But technically, like, this is all feasible on Android right now. Like, you can
draw
over apps, and I don't know, you can take a screenshot a second or something and then have
it. And then slices, too, is making it even more feasible.
Yeah. So, yep. Recently announced Android P feature where parts of app appear in Google search. So yeah, like, this is feasible. But like, per that, the reason like the video showed it that way is because Google doesn't own everything. If it owned everything, it could just build into every single service.
For sure, for sure.
But
speaking of Google, how do you feel about how they're kind of approaching AI from a broader perspective? So I think we might have slightly differing opinions on this. And I say that because I feel like they might be being a little bit too reckless. And I don't know if you saw, did you see this Axios report, which is basically... I forgot the guy's name, but he basically really grilled Google PR, asking for answers to very basic questions about Google Duplex, and PR basically shrugged him off. And so basically his story was, I grilled Google PR and they shrugged me off. So therefore, Google Duplex, you know, maybe we shouldn't believe everything that Google showed us. And I wouldn't take it that far, but I do think there is merit to the grilling that people are doing. And I mean, we at I/O last week, we tried to, you know, chat with, or we tried to ask, we asked at least to try and chat with someone on or near the Duplex team. And
yep.
And, you know, basically, they told us, like, no, not yet. And to me, it's not that, like, I'm not bothered by them not having all the answers or them not being, like, willing. Well, I don't know. My problem is they announced this on stage. They showed it off. And basically everyone's reaction was like, holy cow, this is awesome. Amazing. Amazing. This is crazy. Which is basically the reaction to every early tech demo you'll ever see. But in this case, I feel like this has wide-reaching societal implications, and AI in general has wide-reaching societal implications. And kudos to Google and Sundar for taking the stage last week and starting off the chemo with kind of the tone of like, we know this is a big deal and we want to be responsible and we feel an extreme or heavy responsibility to get this right or whatever. Mm-hmm. So kudos to them for that, because, you know, they didn't have to do that. And I feel like some companies who are dabbling in AI aren't doing that. And so in a way that's a good thing. And so I applaud Google for that. But at the same time, they did that and then show off Duplex, didn't touch on any of the, you know, implications of, you know, how would people feel about this? How, you know, are they going to disclose it? They didn't mention whether or not they're going to disclose it on stage. That, in my opinion, was their first mistake. We had to ask someone after the fact, say, hey, like, is this intentionally misleading? Like, is Google intentionally trying to trick people into thinking that this is a human? And we were told something kind of like on background. Like, we weren't even given an on the record answer. It was kind of like on background, we're going to give them, you know, we're going to disclose this kind of, and, you know, other publications after that, a day later or whatever, got on the record answers saying, yes, every time Duplex calls, it would be giving a disclaimer. But my broader point is, I feel like they haven't done a good enough job of, after announcing this, being ready to talk about it. And the quote we got from PR was a few weeks, which why would you like a few weeks? Like, they've been working on Duplex for years. They haven't had time like to be ready to talk about it the day they announce it. Like, I don't know. That's my take.
Okay. I see two things there. The first is Google and execution in general is like not the most concise company, they're not Apple when they present something. Like, one possible way you could view this, the Duplex announcement at I.O. was like, they tried to get it outdoor as soon as possible for the keynote. Like, just get everything ready for the keynote. That's one thing. And the other thing is like, the Google Duplex team not being ready for the ramifications of, like, they didn't think ahead that they made the technology first before thinking about the impacts. I think it's more the first case, that this is just Google's standard lack of like order and like presentation, which is not to excuse it. Like, they've gotten better over time, but if you want to make such big, huge societal impacts, you need to step up your game for these simple, basic things. And you can't treat it just like any other product launch, as with YouTube Music, which we'll talk about soon. But yeah, I think like I want to give them the benefit of the doubt that because this is as impressive as it is, because with the way they announced it, it was Sundar, he introed it, then he gave it off to Scott Huffman, the head of assistant engineering or something like that. Then Sundar came back to present Duplex. He was putting his face, his value behind this being a real thing. And I think that's why I at least like give Google the benefit of the doubt that this is a real thing.
Well, we can talk about that. I mean, I think it's a given that it's a real thing. And I think that all of the speculation we've been seeing from various pundits is just cynical. Ridiculous. Like, it's cynical, but I think it's just, I mean, I don't think that they're really looking at the whole picture. I don't think anyone who's been following Google closely for the last couple of years would doubt that they have the technical ability to do this.
Yeah,
that's the most obvious thing to me. They by far have the best voice recognition systems, and I think they've trained. I mean, they're the inventor of the TPU, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they if anyone has the ability to do this, Google has the ability to do this. And then the other thing is just that saying that it's not real, or saying that it was heavily edited, is basically calling Sundar a liar. And like you said, Sundar went out on stage. You know, this wasn't some other VP. This was Sundar, you know, showing this off. And he said, quote, that we called a real salon. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean obviously that no CEO ever lies and no CEO ever tells a half truth. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it seemed like, I mean, one, believable, and two, I like you said, I would give Sundar and Google the benefit of the doubt here because it's not far-fetched for them at all. And then the other aspect for me is, I don't think that if they did edit it for the sake of the presentation or for the sake of, you know, the demo, that doesn't discount the technological, like,
yeah,
like, I guess
the tech. It doesn't discount the tech whatsoever.
Yeah. It doesn't discount the accomplishment, and I don't think that necessarily would show that. Even if they did edit it, I don't know if that would show that this is quote unquote fake, you mm-hmm. know? But I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'll just throw this in. I am kind of in agreement that it might have been edited a little bit. You know, Axios and someone else both brought up, you know, kind of various aspects that seemed a little bit suspicious. Like Axios said they called 20 different
hair salons.
Yeah. They called 20 different hair salons and they all answered with the business name. And in the case of this demo, the person on the other end just said like, "Hi, how can I help you?" or whatever. And I don't know. What do you think happened here? Do you think that the call, I mean, I think personally the call is real, 100% real. Is it edited? Did they cut out the beginning? Did they cut out the, you know, was there a disclaimer? Was there a, "Hey, we're calling, this is going to be a Google AI. Are you okay with this? Also, if you are, can you sign this NDA?" Do you think that was the situation here?
But I think when they tested this, I think they no, because that defeats the purpose of testing it against humans. I think it's real, but I don't think they did the disclosure stuff until everybody started criticizing them, if we had to be honest. Because on stage they said there would be some level of like, "I'm calling on behalf of hi, I'm calling on behalf of your name," and then but then after all the backlash, they decided to like say, "I'm the Google assistant" or something along those lines. But yeah, again, at the end of the day, I think it's real. I just think that the execution needed, to get the execution right, they needed a much more public venue, more public discussion.
Yeah. I think just last night, did you see that? Or let's see, yeah, yesterday, did you see that Mashable thinks they found the place?
Yes. Yeah, and they call. That whole drama. They found the restaurant in question. So I think that's fine.
Yeah, good digging, by the way, on their part.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, my takeaway basically is that the tech is real, 100%. The call may have been edited somewhat for the sake of the presentation. Another thing that is kind of weird that Google hasn't explained, and I don't think anyone really has explained, is that California has two-party consent. So both people on both ends of the call would have to agree to for recording purposes,
mm-hmm.
and so to make it legal. And so, you know, did Google just record it without asking and then say, "Hey, don't sue us," or "Don't take us to court" or whatever? Or, you know, did Google get permission in the first place, which would have thrown off? Did Google say, "Hey, we're going to be calling you with our AI within a week. Hint, hint. We're not going to tell you when it is, but can we have permission to call it, to record it whenever we do call you?" I mean, maybe that's what they did. I don't know. But that's like, I mean, that's something that I haven't really seen many people talk about, but I think, you know, they would have had to have two-party consent. And somebody mentioned, I agree with this, that, you know, to use Duplex, it's not just, you know, you would have to record. It's not just for the presentation. like for Duplex to take this information in and process it and provide a response, it necessarily would have had to have been recorded, even if they weren't presenting at I/O. So yeah, Google would have had to get permission somehow. But anyways, we can move on. Basically, we haven't put the whole picture together. I will add that we're told by one tipster that I don't want this to be taken the wrong way, because I feel like there's kind of a sensationalized headline going on here that Google Duplex is fake, or you know, there's like this story that, you know, of skepticism. And so I want to make very clear that I'm not skeptical that the tech is fake. However, I think it's obvious that Google is not being as straightforward with this, generally speaking, both in talking about the technology and talking about the long-term AI implications of not just Google Duplex, but everything else Google's working on in AI. So I want to make it very clear that I'm not skeptical of the tech side of things. However, we were told by a tipster, and I'll just throw this in just because I think it's interesting, and I would recommend taking it with a grain of salt because this is kind of like secondhand information. But apparently engineers within Google right now are aware of one detail about Google Duplex that Google hasn't let on, which is that the actual responses are not dynamically generated. So as far as I have heard and understand, the way Duplex works, at least as shown in the demo, so maybe the technology is broader and working more than this, but or more complicated than this, but at least in the case of the specific demos that were shown at I/O, Google Duplex is those responses. So like, hi, I'd like to make an appointment for 10 a.m. or whatever. And then it says for who? And then they say, for Lisa. Those responses are being dynamically, you know, the machine learning is telling, you know, Duplex which response.
Yeah,
it's telling them which response to use, but the responses themselves, as far as I understand, are not completely dynamically generated. They're pre-scripted. So again, I don't want this to show like, oh, Google's being so misleading, or Google's like, this is fake. But I think it is worth mentioning, at least, that we're hearing this just for the sake of, I guess, transparency, and just because I think it's interesting, because I want to understand Google Duplex just as much as anyone. Mm-hmm. I want to understand what happened at the keynote, and I want Google to be clear, like, this is exactly what we did. And right now they're being vague and ambiguous. And so I would like them to be clear, and that's my take. And so, yeah, what do you think about it?
Even in the scenario you just suggested, that does not take away the understanding part of it. So if it were scripted, like you suggest, like the tips that suggested to us, that doesn't take away like Google's capability of understanding the person on the line.
Exactly.
And then
exactly.
Be able to serve up a response that fits that that database of responses this Duplex knows the meaning, like what each response conveys and how that works with the original query, like that in no way takes away from that.
Yeah, totally. And I guess to close this out, if you haven't read the actual blog post that Google put up about Google Duplex on the day of I/O, which you definitely should, it outlines all just the sheer complexity. Like, I think it's really easy anytime we're talking about any AI technology to like discount the complexity of this. And I think this blog post does a really good job of explaining exactly why Duplex is so unique, and why, or I guess the real complexity of understanding human speech. And so I'll just leave on that note. You should really go read that post. I highly doubt that anything in that post is a lie. I think you can probably trust it. So yeah, what else do we have to talk about today besides Duplex?
If we're still talking about I/O, you had a very good recap of what material design is at.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've said this like a bunch of times at this point, but you know, I wrote this post about material design and Google's material theme and kind of what's happening with material design. I think the bulk of that post was mostly, or the bulk of the value of that post was lots of quotes from Matthias himself, which I have to mention this because I just thought it was so funny. And most people don't read the comments on 9to5 Google. You absolutely should read them and comment more often if you don't. But on that post, I quoted Matthias a lot from the press briefer at I.O. And I finally had a chance after we recorded our last Alphabet Scoop to write all this up. One of the commenters, so we're talking a lot about how basically the new material design is like a system for creating systems. And one of the commenters said, are there any videos, are there any video interviews of Matthias Duarte? I feel like since he's moved up to VP, the guy is a metaphor and an idea, or even a system, if you will. I just thought that was so funny. It's just true. I mean, it was a rare sight to see him at I.O. and at all, but mm-hmm. But yeah, he's right. There's not very many video interviews of him. So if you want access to the words straight from the man himself, then you should go check out my post on material design. It's over at 9to5 Google, and you can check out the link in the description of the podcast over at 9to5 Google. So yeah. Other I.O. things that kind of happened since I.O. is all those Google Photos features are rolling out, right?
Yep. So this was like one very good part of this year's I.O. was that Google was ready to show off and to release and afterwards release all these features they announced, which is so much nicer than last year where I feel there was such a big gap between availability. So yeah, with Photos specifically, we got access to ColourPop, which takes your black and white images and makes them, or any image in general, just makes them have more color. And then these smart suggestions, which are really useful. When you open an image, these chips appear that like suggest to if you want to auto to increase the brightness, to fix the rotation, to archive.
Do you have any of these features on your phone yet?
Yeah, I do. And
Have you used any of them yet?
I've been using them with the screenshots given our line of work, which is getting me to
the archive suggestion.
Oh yeah, because my Google Photos library is a total mess of screenshots, and you can barely find like a personal picture in there these days. Yeah, so, yeah, it is useful.
Yeah, yeah, I actually haven't opened up Google Photos since we got back from I.O. because I've basically been locked inside, so I haven't taken a single photo. Nice. The other thing we talked about, last week news, Google News also was announced, and it brings Google's material theme, kind of tying back to that, and today actually, yes, and actually today the new Google News on the web is rolling out. So if you haven't checked that out, it's got the new, you know, Google material theme. It kind of looks like the Google Pay website a little bit.
Yeah, it looks different from Gmail though, like in a distinct way. This does not feel like Gmail or even Google Drive, which I find.
Yeah, so I think what happened with Gmail is that I think Google, the Gmail team, might have realized that Gmail has a distinct look of it, like a distinct look of its own, and also, it's obviously like Google's most popular service, and so.
Yeah.
I think they felt more inclined to retain
usability.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that, and also retain some of the previous look. And I think we mentioned that in one of our previous episodes was that, you know, after using it for a couple hours, you wouldn't even realize that you're using the new one. And yep. So, yeah, I feel like there's a lot more of the old Gmail sticking around in the new Gmail. Whereas, you know, Google News and Google Pay are, I think, fresher initiatives where they feel more freedom to just experiment and be a little bit bolder with the design. Mm-hmm. However, it seems like bold just means white everything.
Yeah.
So not bold, the opposite of bold.
I mean, it's just like dark theme. I need dark themes very badly because most of us use our phones at night, Google. I'm sure you do too.
Hey, they're trying to help you not do that. Yeah. So maybe the whiteness of the Google material theme is actually one of their wellness initiatives.
Okay.
Because if they don't have anything that's dark or colored, then you're not going to use your phone ever after 8 p.m. because you're not going to want to look at it.
Okay. That's a good conspiracy theory, Stephen.
Although it doesn't really work for our line of work.
Yeah. So yeah, but Google News, have you had a chance to use it much?
So yesterday I went in and I added all the 9 to 5 sites, which
nice.
All of our listeners, you should go do that too. As we need to update the logos though. I think they're automatically pulling from the favicon.
Oh, and that's horribly pixelated.
Yeah, it's a little dated. I think I'm not sure what it's pulling from because it's not the same as the favicon. I'm looking at the favicon right now and it's not the same. But we definitely need to figure out a way to update that.
News.
Sorry.
I didn't use Google News. A lot of people use Google News, and I was like in the minority for not using it. So like after the design update, I started diving in. And what I found is that it's so much better than the Google feed. And this is coming as a person who likes the Google feed. Like, it's okay, the Google feed is not as good as Google Now in the past, but I use it. I find useful articles in the Google feed. And Google News is so much more of an improvement. Like the recommendations are always on point, and like the ability to know why something was recommended is pretty good. So I'm a full convert, and I think like the Google feed should be phased out for Google News, or should use the same backend or something like that.
Yeah, let's actually pause there a second. I have a question for you. So you say that I think it's widely agreed that the old Google Now feed, you know, versus Google feed today, it's like night and day. And I guess what's happened is it's slowly morphed, I feel like. Morphed. Right.
Google Now was like personalized suggestions. And this Google feed thing is just news.
Yeah, I remember the original vision for Google Now was like, we're going to give you a suggestion for this trip on Google Maps, or, you know, it tried to be more functional, and Google feed feels more like just a news feed.
Yeah.
As someone that's a fan of the Google feed, what do you think is so unpopular about the Google feed? And if Google has shifted away from that more functional, like, approach to Google Now, do you think that was just not that useful in the first place? Like, what do you think happened here?
When they announced it, I don't think it was ready. They didn't have, when they, whatever, 2012, 2013, I don't think they had the capabilities, the artificial intelligence, if you will, to like do personalized suggestions that are fully useful versus like algorithmic, like, you have an upcoming fight that doesn't require too much AI, personal analysis that just pulls it from the email. So what I think that Google quickly saw back then was that they weren't ready for it. And they've only recently become ready with what they're doing with Google Assistant. Like there's the cool feature when this coming summer or this fall, when you open up the assistant and you slide up, it gives you like that old Google Now view of your upcoming flights of places you might like. But anyways, going back, I think once Google realized they weren't ready to do it, they switched to something that's just like, we're good at suggesting news articles for you. We know what you like. So they tried to make it more of an, instead of a more personal thing, what they tried to do is like something that you find some sort of amusement from.
Yeah,
that's how it went down.
Here's the cynical take. The cynical take is Google wants ad money.
Yeah, these articles
And these ad accounts, all the articles are just covered in AdSense. And so, you know, I think it might have been a sneaky way for Google to put, you know, its own business interests right there on your home screen, which now that I think about it is really sneaky, because, you know, we get mad at other companies for, you know, Samsung or whatever Android OEM for putting bloatware on our phones or putting, you know, having a launcher that's covered in, you know, pre-installed apps or ads or whatever it is. Google does the same thing, but they do it in a sneakier way, I guess.
My argument against is that some of these articles for me are really good. They're personalized. Like, I wouldn't have seen them otherwise. So,
yeah, I get Electra, and if I've Googled mine all the time, which I appreciate that. And the same thing's happening to me in Google News, actually. The very first time I open up Google News, Electra at the very top. And so, yeah, speaking of Electra.
So, I think that pretty much closes out I.O.
So what happened since I.O.? We had Google One. That was one of the big announcements earlier this week. And then
on
YouTube
Monday,
Music and stuff.
Why didn't they announce it at I.O.? So Google One is this. It's the new simplified cloud storage plans, which are meant to replace the Drive ones or to add new features to the Drive ones. So in terms of pricing, everybody still gets 15 gigs free. Well, that's currently how it is. But there are there's a new 200 gigabyte plan for $299 per month. And for $999, you used to get 1 terabyte. You now get 2 terabytes. So that's like in terms of like the physical storage, which most people will be interested in. That's how that works out now. It's you get a new tier and you get more for the $10 tier. So that's storage. But the other bigger thing that you and I recognized was that customer support. With Google One, Google said Google users who... users who use more storage, who are more likely to be bigger users of other Google services. So the idea is that for these super users, they want to give one-tap access to experts. And they haven't clarified this yet. Google One hasn't launched. This transition is happening slowly over the coming weeks and months. So it could be either a phone, like, one-tap access could be phone customer support or text and chat. Somebody suggested that it could be duplex, which is I found highly amusing.
I think that's the big story with Google One is, you know, it's cool. They're rebranding their storage offerings to make more sense. You know, whenever you're buying more storage across Google products. But the big story, I think, is, like you said, the service thing. So this is the first time. Oh, well, I guess it's not the first time. So I think in the last few years, we've started to see anytime you're on like a Google support page for most of their products, hardware and some software, you'll see like a chat box pop on the right and bottom right corner, which is, you know, you get a chat with someone who works, you know, some Google support person. That's been a thing. But do we really know what the new like premium level of support is for One subscribers? I don't think we do. I mean, we assume it might be like in-person phone calls or something like that. Like apparently G Suite has stellar support. Like you can just call a phone number and you just got a real person on the other end immediately. And so maybe that's what this is. Maybe Google's extending that G Suite level of support to Google One subscribers. I could see that. I mean, I think we did a poll this week. How'd those results turn out? Have you seen them yet?
I'm bringing them up now.
So we asked basically if
is the extra customer support that Google One offers really valuable?
Yeah. We don't really know what that is, but we asked if people find it valuable. And our options were, I get lost trying to use Google services, or yes, I don't want to have to pay extra for support, or I'm a pro user, which I think that was the winner basically, which makes sense with our audience.
The third option was no, but it's going to be valuable to my grandparents, which I think is, it's like the key there. Like, some people definitely need extra help with technology. And if there is a support option available, I think this would take it. That many the people who need it would take it, because it's coupled with storage.
Yeah, and I think another thing with this that maybe people haven't really thought about yet is that sometimes things happen with various Google services that you might not be able to get fixed unless you know someone who knows someone at Google. So, like, I can't think of really a great example right now. But, I mean, for instance, like, if you have an AdSense problem and you aren't, you know, in our case, you know, we're part of a larger publisher network. So, we have contacts who directly work with us because, you know, our ad network is pretty huge. But, you know, an indie publisher who's got a website with 20,000 page views a month or whatever, and if they get banned from AdSense for some unjustified reason... Or whatever. That's one of those cases where historically you've been pretty much out of luck, because you know Google's customer service is sometimes just completely non-existent. I can't think of any like more consumer related examples that would be related to Drive or Calendar or something. But I guess you know occasionally. You know, you have a bug or some kind of glitch or some problem that's affecting your account.
Yeah, like your let's say you lost photos or something in Google Photos, or you lost an upload in Drive.
It's rare. It's rare. Those cases are rare. But you know, in those off cases where something weird happens with your account, I think this is going to be really useful. You know, because I think this might be like the first time for some of those services that people have been able to just call a phone number and say, hey, I'm having this problem with Gmail. It's a legit problem. You guys should get on it, you know? And it's pretty much previously you've been stuck with Google product support forums or whatever.
Yeah.
So
that's Google One. We'll definitely cover it more as it rolls out. And
it should be
an interesting few months.
It'll also be interesting to see if any of those other app icons or service icons that we posted turn out to be something. So the first one is Google News, and the second one is One, which I wrongly guessed was going to be a refresh of the old Google One Today app, which you can find that on the Play Store. So I was wrong on that. I'm happy to admit that I was wrong on that, because I think this is cooler. Well, actually, maybe not. Maybe it would be nice to have a refresh of Google One Today so we can donate to charity. But the other things were like Google Ads. So there's an ads icon. Maybe we'll see Google Ads launch in the next coming weeks. We'll see. But in related news, Google did launch another service this week. And that is YouTube Music, the new YouTube Music, the long-awaited, very confusing refresh of Google's music offerings.
I wish I had Google One to call support about the announcement, because, oh boy.
Go ahead.
It was launched officially at 10 p.m. Wednesday night, and boy, was it confusing. So like the backstory was... that it was so on Wednesday, throughout Wednesday, the backstory is that that's when YouTube PR gave their briefings to select journalists, and somebody broke embargo ahead of the Wednesday, next Tuesday launch. So they had to rush to finalize their blog post and get the product pages up for all of this. So like 5 hours later, they officially said, this is the new YouTube Premium. Okay, so let's start with the music thing, because Google Play Music, what's coming next, that's been reported for months. So this is the new YouTube Music. It's the app, if you've used it, which is actually already quite good, in my opinion, looks exactly the same. The same three tabs, the same navigation, the same layout, But now, the big focus of this new YouTube Music is personalization. They want to... They're using your previous listening history, your location, and your activity. So let's say you're at the gym, it offers you like music to get you pumped up. And if you're like late at night, it might suggest music to wind down. So that's like the big focus, like AI, obviously, and personalization on this dynamically updating home screen every time you refresh throughout the day. So that's that, recommendations. That's clear and straightforward. The other thing that they're pushing is, so you've on YouTube, you find these so many covers, but in the new YouTube Music, the idea is to push official versions. Like from the hands-on videos, which I've noticed, it's that instead of offering videos, what YouTube Music is pushing audio first. So it's the official albums, the official track listings, artist radio, remixes, covers, live versions. All these are mostly audio. Then you get like physically as you scroll down that home screen feed, you get music videos and like other stuff like that. But like the clear focus is this audio thing. Better compete with Spotify and Apple Music and to replace Play Music.
Yeah, so what's the story for people who have, let's just say people who are subscribed to YouTube Red / Google Play Music before today? What does it look like for them now? So they get YouTube Premium now.
Yes,
for whatever price they previously paid, which for some people was $8 and some people was $10, right?
Yes, if you already have YouTube Red, you are getting the replacement, which is now called YouTube Premium. It's the exact same thing, and you're getting it for the same. If you've paid $7.99 or $9.99 per month, you're going to keep paying that. You're grandfathered in. However, for new users, first off, you might not even have to pay because there's a free YouTube Music, which is ad-supported, and Google hasn't detailed it exactly, but it sounds like the exact same service, the same music premium paid service, but ad, so who knows? I'm sure you'll get more about it on Tuesday. But then there's the music premium at $10 per month. You get ad-free content, background playback, and offline downloads just for music. Music premium just gives you music content. But if you're a new subscriber and you want, again, ad-free content, background playback, and offline downloads for all of YouTube, you have to upgrade to that YouTube Premium at $11.99, $2 more. Most of the confusion was based around like existing users upgrading. So again, if you pay, you're going to keep paying what you've been paying, and you're going to
get the top tier.
Right. Yeah, you get the top tier. So,
yeah. So
that was surprisingly hard to get across.
Yeah. So if I don't have anything at all, I'm not subscribed to anything, and I subscribe to YouTube. The other problem with this is the naming is just
it's so confusing.
It's not and good. I mean, like the history here is so bad. I'm gonna pull this up real quick because I think it's worth mentioning, but YouTube, all of YouTube services, but like especially this YouTube / Google Play Music stuff has had just a terrible history of very confusing and changing names. So Jason Howell, you may know him as the guy who hosts This Week in Tech News Weekly, and he hosts All About Android as well. He tweeted this, so Google Messaging has gone, you know, talk to Waze. This isn't necessarily linear, but you know, we've had so many different products. We have Talk, Waze, Buzz, Huddle, Hangouts, Messages, or Messenger, Android Messenger, and then Android Messages because the app got renamed, right? Yeah. And then you know, there were Spaces, and then there was
Spaces.
Google I/O 2016. Yes.
Oh, that was cute.
Allo and Duo as well. And so their messaging strategy is just all over the place. And the next thing is they're basically just saying, yeah, we're just going to do Android messages and Duo, and we're just going to put RCS. It's not chat. I'm not going to even call it chat. It's not. It doesn't deserve the name. Google has, they have had no consistency with their product naming names. They're probably going to change the name. I'm just going to call it RCS because that's what it's been. So they're just adding, and have been already adding, RCS to Android messages. And that's their next messaging move.
That's messaging. That's messaging.
Google and YouTube / Google Play Music, anything music. Jason, he mentions Music Beta, which was before Google Music.
Yeah, remember it was Hollow. It was right. I remember that, actually.
Right, and then there was Google Music, and which I think that's the name that we should maybe the circle is finally going to come back around, because everything else is going back to Google Blank. Google Music, Google Play Music, because that came after they introduced the Play brand. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, yeah. And then after that, they did Google Play Music All Access, right? Mm-hmm. I think those were like separate announcements.
Is the music key on that list? Because that was also a thing, if you remember.
Yeah, and then YouTube Music Key. That was the very first premium ad-free music thing on YouTube, right?
Yep.
And then they rebranded that to YouTube Red, which was, it's not right for various reasons. So it was originally YouTube Music Key, which was, they were trying to pitch it as, this is an ad-free music service. And then they were like, okay, this isn't going so well, so let's just make it ad-free YouTube and make it a premium. So basically YouTube Premium.
Which
so they
what
did
anybody
YouTube
wants.
Red.
That's what anybody wants. Just
right.
No ads.
Right. And then they did YouTube Music as a separate app, which was the beginnings of them kind of doing this partitioning thing with YouTube. So like now YouTube is multiple things. So there's YouTube Music, YouTube Gaming, there's YouTube proper. And then so the most recent announcements are, so now there's YouTube Music, the app, YouTube Music Premium, which is the YouTube Music app ad-free premium subscription, which is $10 a month. And now there's YouTube Premium, which is what used to be YouTube Red, and now it's more expensive.
Yeah.
So, long story short, this is a mess, and I don't trust that anything is going to stay the same. Hopefully, this is a sign that... I think we have to take all this in the context of also that Google, I think, still is shutting down Play Music. Google's official on-the-record response to people who are asking right now is, nothing is changing anytime soon. But I still, I mean, I think the plan is, if things go well for Play Music to be shuttered. What's your take on this?
Okay, let's Play Music. We can spend hours on that. So, as you've pointed out, the Google Play branding appears to be going away. You're a big proponent of the Google Play Books, Google Play Movies, Google Play Music, all of that being shut down.
It seems like it is.
The way it's shut down, but they're just rebuilding it all on YouTube. So what's the difference, really?
Yeah,
besides the duplicity, like it. So they're starting off with making YouTube more of a music thing. There's already movies there. That makes sense. So if just YouTube just becomes their whole media thing, which is good branding, but they really do need to get away from the idea that it's just videos. That's a whole mess in this transition, if they do it. So yeah, again, like I said, there's no official comment of what's happening at Play Music. I did ask, like, are there any, what's like the future of it? And they didn't, they just gave me the same comment they gave everybody else, that it's at this time, nothing is happening.
Right.
That it's just going to stay there. But like the idea of it staying there static with no updates for years on end, because they can't do anything with this Cloud Walker, which so many people like love so much, and that would be the greatest outcry in the world.
Yeah, so they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, kind of, because they launched this YouTube Music, and I think the long-term plan, based on what we've heard from sources and based on, I think, the evidence, the public evidence is that Google's building out all of the YouTube or the Google Play Music features in YouTube Music. And that's the long-term plan. But at the same time, right now, they launched YouTube Music and it's not finished and it's not compatible with Spotify's and Apple Music's of the world. Google Play Music is the closest thing to that. And so they launched YouTube Music, assumably because they just wanted to get this out the door because apparently it was supposed to launch like months ago. And meanwhile, they have, you know, Google Play Music subscribers who are like, okay, what's going to happen? And the problem is if they tell YouTube Music or Google Play Music subscribers that Google Play Music is shutting down and there's not an equivalent showing up in YouTube Music yet, everyone's going to switch to Spotify, which is what you did, right?
Yeah. Oh, funny story. on Tuesday, I signed up for a Spotify subscription. Yeah. So
long time Google Play.
Yeah, always Google Play, because again, that crowd walker, I went straight from iTunes to this because it had an equivalent, like iTunes calls it iTunes Match. Google Play.
Okay,
music.
Maybe you can explain. Sorry for the yawn. Maybe you can explain this to me. Why do people care about the cloud locker when Spotify has like 99.9% of music?
Because it's okay for me, it's like an ownership thing. I don't like one day want to like stop subscribing to Spotify and not have access to like files or just like, because like you can buying content is like, it's for me, it's like a mental difference. It's like, there's no frustration about like the idea of like having to constantly pay $10 a month to get access to my songs, this highly personal collection and order of things is like, that's, I can't live like that. I need to know that there's a copy somewhere that I own. But yeah, that's like my specific thing, the ownership. But like for people, some people have like live versions which aren't available anywhere else. They've curated, they've ripped CDs and stuff, and they still want to get access to that. So like, that's like the idea between why a cloud locker is so appealing. Right. And like Amazon Music Prime, whatever, that's also confusing. They shut down their service. So right now, if you want it, it's Google or Apple Music, iTunes. Who knows how long that's lasting for. So like the last available option is Google's.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's, I mean, yes, I'll give you that, but I feel like it just seems like a niche use case.
Oh, totally. And but that's to that extent, that's why I think like the current YouTube Music, like this, you only stream it. You have the option to like cash it offline. It's fine. Like the product they're going to launch with on Tuesday might be fine. These algorithm, like YouTube recommendation algorithms for songs are very good. Like I've always been using it. Like for the past few months, I've been using YouTube Music over Google Play Music because like I find the algorithm so much better, the recommendation history. So like that's one thing.
Yeah. Another. So one of our commenters in the chat says, his name is Timo. I don't want to botch his name, but he says Google Play Music is available in over 100 countries while YouTube Music is available in one country. Yeah. And that's one thing that I think us as Americans, you know, spoiled Americans, we tend to forget too, is that Google Play Music doesn't have an international placement at all yet.
So yeah, so YouTube Music, YouTube Red is where YouTube Music is available in 5 countries. And that's what will be the first 5 countries to get this new premium music thing. In the coming months, it's coming to 14 more nations. And the idea is that if you've had a Google Play Music subscription, you'll be getting access to YouTube Music Premium. Is it premium? Oh my God, the name's getting to me. So I was like, is it YouTube Premium Music? That's so confusing. But yeah, that's a good point, the international thing. But YouTube, this new YouTube Music thing is coming to more countries. That's like Google has said that. The CEO of YouTube has said that it's coming to hundreds. That you, at the time, YouTube Red is coming to hundreds of more countries.
So did you take this official statement? Did you take it as a walk back on previous? Like
honestly, I did. Yeah, because like all these Recode and CNET. the way they phrased it was that during their interviews, they got Google to say that these new features are coming to all the Google Play Music features are coming to YouTube Music, and that eventually, no timeline, no year, that Google Play Music is going to be shut down. But we have no whiff of that in these official blog posts whatsoever.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. But I think still, I mean, I think that the plan from the beginning was for them to just, so I don't know if you remember, but this version that launched like yesterday and that's going to be coming out. So like that version has been tested internally for a while. And there's like a distinction between like, this is not the version that's replacing Google Play Music. But there is a version coming that will eventually be the end of Play Music. And so I think that, you know, like we've said, I think that eventually it's done.
My take is that it's never going to die because the Cloud Walker is like, people love it, but I think it's like behind the scenes, Google hates it because like there's a whole mess of rights and file management. Like when they stream you a song, it in theory, legally, they need to stream you your copy. Like they can't stream like from a pool. Like they can't stream the same file to millions of users. They need to stream the copy you uploaded. So like I think that's like a legal mess that they really don't want to bring to YouTube Music, to YouTube in general. So like, I think this solution is just like, give it an update, keep it for like, I don't know, like a few more years when people don't care or like when behaviors have appropriately changed.
Yeah, here's what'll be interesting though. What if with this launching, YouTube Music doesn't really pick up steam? What happens then? You know, I feel like that's another reason. That might be another reason that Google's not saying, yeah, Google Play Music is shutting down in 6 months and we're giving it an end of life. They're not giving it an end of life because they don't even know if YouTube Music's going to really do so well.
In this case, it's sad. They need this to work. Like they are going like. You will know what YouTube Music is by this end of the year. Like they're like full billboards, print advertising, like celebrities, musicians. They're going to push this so much. From one reason is because like YouTube has so much music and like the recording industry hates how they're not making more money from it or something like that. And this new offering for YouTube is one way to appease them. So they need this to work.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. I mean, I'm sure within a few months we'll start to see whether or not YouTube Music Premium is doing so well. Speaking of numbers, we have some good looking and some optimistic numbers for Google Home sales today. Yeah. So it turns out that let's see. So 2.4 million Google Homes devices were shipped. Was this Q1? Making up 26% of the market, and Amazon had less than double that. So this is a really big victory for Google, just showing how much they're competing and catching up with Amazon after Amazon had pretty much 100% of the smart speaker market.
Yeah, like if one, like you can compare it back to YouTube Music, like Google pushed home, they pushed assistant-enabled devices, the ecosystem so hard, and like it worked, they're winning. Like they went all out at CES, they went out all out at South By, like it's working, so it could work.
And my take on it is I'm really happy to see it because I think Google Home is the better product. I really do. Okay. And I think the Google Home ecosystem is better, especially now that we're seeing smart displays. So with the Google Home ecosystem, we've got, you know, the Google Home Mini, the Google Home Max, the Google Home. They all work with just as many, if not more, services, third-party services than Amazon's products do, I think, at this point. And yeah. also the other Google hardware. So like these things tie in with your Google Pixel to one degree, and also, you know, Chromecasts and, you know, the rest, like Google's really building out an ecosystem now.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see because, you know, as I mentioned earlier on Twitter, it's something that you wouldn't have even imagined 3 years ago. Oh, before the Google Pixel event, that first October event, where they announced a ton of hardware that day. They announced the Google Wi-Fi, Google Home. Yeah. Well, they didn't announce Google Home there. They launched the Google Home, Google Pixel, Chromecast Ultra, all that stuff on that Daydream, the first Daydream headset. That was a big day. Looking back, it was such a big day for Google hardware, and it's really cool to see that they're competitive. Speaking of Google hardware, a report today came out saying that Google's working on a standalone AR headset. So I don't know if I mentioned this in a report before. I feel like I've mentioned it somewhere, but as far as I've been aware for a while now, like a year or two, there have been two independent AR efforts at Google. AR hardware efforts at Google. One of them is at X under Alphabet. So that's Google Glass. That's Glass Enterprise. And they have a website up and everything. Like they've gone all out public on Google on Glass Enterprise. So that's a thing. And we can debate whether or not Glass is AR. but then the other thing is Clay Bavor. I'm pretty sure he's still the VP of the VR.
In VR.
Yeah, augmented reality in VR. He, as far as I've heard, well, we know he's been in charge of Daydream and that whole initiative and VR in general initiatives at Google. But I heard like a year ago that his group was also working on AR hardware. Mm-hmm. And so this report today came out saying that it's from WinFuture, I think, which they have a pretty good track record, saying that Google's working on an AR headset, not a Google Glass, which your header image was, I think, somewhat misleading.
I'm just saying heads-up displays for the first augmented reality.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a standalone AR headset, not Google Glass related at all. Probably, I would guess, and the report didn't say this, I would guess this is one of Clay Bavor's projects. Yeah, and if you know more than me on this, then feel free to correct me. But my email inbox is open. what do we hear about this thing?
So we have basic hardware specs. It's running a Qualcomm QC603. It's an Internet of Things optimized processor. There might be some element of custom chips involved. We know that it has camera sensors and microphones, so that could be voice input. So like we have, and it's there's no wires, it's untethered. So like we have this general shape of, let's imagine that it's a HoloLens, like that's what it looks like. We know nothing whatsoever about the software component of this. What is Google's AR operating system going to be based on? It's like up in the air. Like we have seen pieces of features, Google Lens, like real-time image recognition as you point your camera towards something, and like Google Maps shows you're able to navigate with a cartoon character and just point your phone in the world. Like we have the features, but we have no idea how that comes all together. Would you think it's Android or a new thing?
I think Daydream is right. I mean, so like you can easily imagine. So think about the Daydream home screen right now. It's like it has a literal nature real world backdrop.
Yeah.
What just I mean, I could easily, yeah, just lose the backdrop and there you go. There's your AI or AR interface. And actually that might be something to think about as Daydream continues to evolve. We should keep an eye on it to see if there's any evidence that they're working on making it, you know, more compatible with mixed reality headsets.
Honestly, it should
from
be
a UI perspective.
The final OS name would be based on Android, but they should call it Daydream at the end of the day. Like that's a good name. I've always
I think that totally works for AR. And you know, I think it could use the same software. So
Quanta,
Google is working with Quanta, the same people who made the Pixel C tablet, on manufacturing. The Win Future report said they started talking to partners early this year, which could suggest it's not ready for a while. But then another view is, like, since you what based on what you've heard, like, they could just be ready to manufacture it now after, like, getting the hardware ready. So who knows when this is ready? And who knows whether, like, the first one is a consumer product or it's like a developer thing?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they've been pretty secretive about it. Yeah. It's probably a pretty small group too. Yeah, so I think we're getting close, or we're well over our hour now. So what are our app update news for the week? We got a few little things. One of them being Google Pixel Buds. I guess this isn't really an app story, but Google Pixel Buds got a pretty decent update today this week. Yep. With some much requested gestures, right?
Yeah, so you can change the double tap gesture to skip songs. So that's, like, obvious for headphones. A triple tap turns it off so that you don't have to put in a case every time. And you can easily switch devices pairing wise. So everything else this week was basically Google I/O features coming out. So with Gmail, which was announced earlier in the previous month, like AI-powered nudge features, which remind you to follow up on an email, offline Gmail native support, which doesn't require a Chrome extension, is coming out. So you can search, archive, and compose emails and offline and syncs back to the cloud. Like we said, Google News on the web got its material theme. And lastly, this is also a bit hardware, the Galaxy S9 and S9 Plus add support for AR Core, which again is augmented reality.
Yeah, so let's round this out. What are we expecting in the weeks ahead? I think the big thing is that there's just lots of stuff that Google announced at I/O that we're still waiting for. What are the things you're anticipating most? I think there's still assistant features from last year that we're still waiting for, huh?
Yeah. The Google Home, we're still waiting for, like, proactive notifications. And next month is Smart Display Month. We're going to get the first assistant smart displays coming out. So you can expect a ton of coverage around that. Throughout this summer, this upcoming summer, we should be getting all those assistant features, like the Google Now thing I mentioned earlier, and hopefully we're going to see those Google Map features sooner than later before the end of the year.
So all our phone batteries can die. I'm also really excited for these Google Home features, like the Pretty Please thing. For some reason, that's like one of those things I'm just really excited for. I need to learn how to speak more kindly to my Google Home, because I find myself like, if it frustrates me even a little bit, if I say, like, if the music's like really loud and I say hot word, be quiet, and it doesn't hear me and doesn't stop the music, I get really frustrated really quick.
Okay.
I've said my share of expletives to my Google Home.
I can vouch that you're totally a fine person in real life, so I don't think you need it. He's a perfectly cool dude. Thanks.
But yeah, I mean, until then, and until we get some of these features, I'm sure we'll be talking about them more in the coming weeks. You can tune into Alphabet Scoop. Thanks a lot for joining us. I've been Stephen Hall, and this is Abner Lee. We record this podcast every Friday and we publish every Saturday morning. You can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms like iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, which recently got acquired. So maybe some changes are coming to that. We actually saw Pocket Cast was one of the few apps that got a Google material theme really early, or Google showing off. So you should definitely check out Pocket Cast. It's probably sticking around. Google App Podcasts, which is one of those like lesser known sources for podcasts. Basically search for Alphabet Scoop in the Google app on your Android phone and you'll find it. And then Google Play Music, which is probably dying eventually, but you can still find us there. And if you want to, you can check out the archive of this of this podcast over on YouTube, youtube.com/9to5Google. And you can listen to the audio version on our website at 9to5google.com. Thank you for tuning in, everyone. As always, we'll see you next week. And again, thanks, Abner, for joining me.
Bye.